I'm excited to introduce you today to Maura Ahrens-Mehle. She's a movement builder. She's an expert in helping people talk about hard things, the things that we often avoid, especially in the leadership space. She hosts the Anxious Achiever podcast for LinkedIn Presents. And this is won the 2023 Media Award from Mental Health America. It was a 2020 Webby Awards honoree, 2022 Best Commute Podcast Signal Award winner, and is frequently a top 10 management podcast and top 50 business podcast. Her book, The Anxious Achiever, which is about turning your biggest fears into your leadership superpower, was published by Harvard Business Press in April 2023. Maura speaks to and consults frequently with Fortune 500 companies, startups, and government agencies. She's a LinkedIn top 10 voice in mental health, and this year she's shortlisted for the Thinkers 50 Distinguished Achievement in Leadership Award. Maura and I are passionate about helping people rethink the relationship between their mental health and their success, and that's what we are here to speak to you about today. Thank you so much for being here today, virtually, with me, Maura. Personally, I'm a huge fan of Maura and the conversation she has of her purpose and the shift she's creating in business and beyond.
Oh, it's such an honor, Allison. I'm a huge fan as well.
Thanks. Well, I think, why don't we just start with the basics? Let's start with getting some kind of definitions and some understandings of some of these topics that we're going to talk about so we can get everyone on the same page. First of all, what is anxiety? When I say that word anxiety, I think it brings up a lot of different things for different people. And so I would love to just hear from you, what is it, what is about, and is it the same as stress? Is anxiety the same as stress?
Anxiety is such a loaded word, isn't it? It's a word that I think we're scared of because anxiety lies on a spectrum, right? It lies on a spectrum. And first, I want to say that anxiety, as you know, is a natural and necessary human emotion. We all feel it, and in fact, we need it. Anxiety has kept us alive for millennia because what it basically is our nervous system and our brain and our body preparing to respond to a threat. And so I always think about when we were prey millennia ago, that was a really important thing. We learned, oh, there's a rustle in the bushes. Better run, better get my spear out, right? That anxiety, that sense that there might be a threat a few steps ahead kept us alive. It gets our body ready for flight, fight, and sometimes freeze. And so anxiety is an ancient emotion and it's necessary, right? The problem is that sometimes we sense a threat and it's just our 4 p.m. sales meeting. Our brain, as amazing as it is, cannot really distinguish sometimes between what is a physical threat to our well-being or those we love and what is just our feelings, our worries, a lot of investment in something that is happening at work or in life, or for me, when I go to the PTO meeting and worry all the other moms at school don't like me. So anxiety is tricky. And for some of us, we are wired really anxious. We have anxiety disorders, which is a mental illness, and we need treatment for it, right? So anxiety is on a spectrum. I have clinical anxiety. I have for decades. I take medication for it. I get therapy for it. I have a lot of different modalities I use to manage it. Some people aren't wired anxious, but they feel anxious before something big's about to happen or when things feel uncertain. And so it really exists on a spectrum. And I think that's why it makes us anxious, because we worry we're going to lose control to the anxiety.
Oh, I think, thank you. I think that's so fascinating because you're pointing out so many different things.
And why? Yeah, sorry.
that I could pick up on it. Because I think it's fascinating. So you have anxiety, an anxiety disorder, and you manage it really, really well to the point where it doesn't seem to be impeding you. Why does anxiety get such a bad rap? Or is there good anxiety? Is there bad anxiety? I mean, it lies on a spectrum. In your book that was just published this year, which I'm a huge fan of, we talk about how you turn anxiety into a superpower. What does that mean?
So there is good anxiety, and actually there's a great book by one of our colleagues, Wendy Suzuki at NYU, and it's called Good Anxiety. There is a movement in neuroscience that is really trying to reframe anxiety and give it a better reputation than it has, because we do need anxiety. David Barlow, who's one of the, you know, deans of anxiety research and treatment, said without anxiety, nothing would get done. We wouldn't have planted crops. We certainly wouldn't innovate. We wouldn't make art. We wouldn't win medals at the Olympics. We wouldn't show up and kill it at work. Anxiety can be very motivating, right? Because it is an emotion that happens usually in advance of something, right? Often anxiety is anticipation of something in the future. And so when we have something we care about, we're going to feel anxious. I was anxious this morning because I want to do a good job for you. And that's great. Good anxiety is really important to distinguish from anxiety disorder or even chronic anxiety that can really drain us, because good anxiety is sort of time limited. It's state anxiety. It's about something and hopefully passes. People like me who have anxiety disorders, and even many people right now who are just sort of living in a state of chronic anxiety because the world, it doesn't pass. It's with us. And you can often think of it as draining our battery. And so the question is, how do we manage anxiety so that it's not constantly draining our battery? We're in dialogue with it. And we can even learn to use it when it will motivate us.
Yeah, for that push to excel, right? And I think that's where we see the intersection of anxiety and leadership. You do so much work with leaders all around the world. You are a leader. You create movements. You create new conversations. What have you been seeing? You've launched a podcast that is amazingly successful that I absolutely love. It's one of my favorites, where you talk to leaders, you talk to experts about anxiety. What is that intersection between leadership and anxiety? Do you think that leaders are more prone to experiencing anxiety, or do you think that the context of leadership itself just triggers it?
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
So here's the thing, and this is why your work is so important, doing research and actually trying to like understand and apply some of this stuff, because, you know, there is data that high achievers experience more anxiety. Now, do we create that anxiety? Do we enter into situations that are going to make us feel more anxiety, or are we born that way? I think it's a combination of everything. Many of the leaders that I work with, and my big push in my work is to tell the stories of leaders who not only manage anxiety, but who, like myself, might have bipolar disorder, who might have chronic depression, who might have obsessive compulsive disorder, who might be neurodivergent, on the autism spectrum, have ADHD, have dyslexia, what I call having a tricky brain, which makes you have to do things differently and have to have more self-awareness. That's why it's a superpower. Because when you do that work, you build an amazing skill set. And I also think that those of us who understand, gosh, you know, I run a little anxious. I'm always six steps ahead. I can use that in my work. Leaders are paid in a way to be anxious. They're paid to anticipate worst case scenarios, to have a plan, to be good in a time of crisis or uncertainty, right? To have creative solutions. And anxiety actually can drive that and help it. So it's not an easy answer, but I will say that in my experience, leaders feel anxious. Of course they do. They are given a lot of responsibility, paid a lot of money, and have a lot of pressure put on them. And they also are probably people who have learned to use that anxiety to motivate them and push them.
I think that's such an important skill. When would you say is that kind of crucial tipping point between I feel worried, I am planning, I am thinking of the future, I'm feeling that sense of anxiousness about what's to come. What are the signs to look for when it's becoming too much, where it can start to have negative instead of more, powerful positive effects? So when someone's sitting there looking, feeling it themselves, when is it time to kind of stop and take care of yourself or implement some tools?
This is the question, Allison. This is the crux of it all. I call anxiety a double-edged sword, and I'd love to hear your thoughts because obviously you're an expert in this. My big question to people is always, is it working for you? Is it serving you? I can't judge that. I'm not a doctor. I'm not your therapist. If you are anxious during the pandemic, because you are trying to manage a team in a time of huge change and you can't look six steps ahead of yourself, I think that's appropriate, right?
Yeah.
If you're waking up every single day, even when things are good, and you are feeling the worry, the swirling brain, right? To me, when I am stuck in anxiety, it feels like I'm on a hamster wheel that I literally can't stop. My brain is so busy. It's like a hurricane in my brain. That might be time to get help. If anxiety is preventing you from living your life, if it's preventing you from getting on a plane or getting on the subway, talking to people, trying new things, or for me, there have been times when I literally cannot leave my bed, then it's time to get help. And so to me, the really important question is it serving you or is it draining you and really taking too much of your brain and body CPU? What do you think?
I think that's just so, it just resonated with me completely. You're right. The easy question is, I can overcomplicate anything as a scientist and researcher and overthink things. I think the easiest question to ask yourself is it serving you? Is your stress, is your anxiety, is it serving you or is it impeding you? Is it holding you back? And I think, what you mentioned that, if you can't get out of bed, if it's stopping you from kind of taking challenges or taking things, harnessing situations that you would like to, I think it's time to say, what can I do? What kind of pause can I make? And what kind of intervention and strategies and tools can I use to help? I just think that's so important.
I think why this is important also in the context of leadership, first of all, it's awful to have chronic anxiety. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It is very, very difficult. But in leaders who experience chronic anxiety often act it out on their teams. They don't even mean to. They're not bad people. But anxiety is contagious. It's difficult. It's uncomfortable. And when we're anxious all the time, we may want to control things. We may worry so much about an outcome, we won't let other people do their job. We may feel we have to do it, right? And this is why achievers often have more anxiety, is because we create habits that build anxiety. We think we need to do things alone. We think we always need to be right. We think we have to be perfect. We always show up as expecting to get fired or for the worst piece of news to happen. And not only is this hard for ourselves, it's really hard for everyone around us.
Oh, that's such a good point. And kind of summarizing, bringing together those two thoughts, Some of the signs to look for potentially where your anxiety is reaching a level where we need to do something about it, we need to enact tools. If you look, you've got kind of the cognitive signs, that overthinking, the ruminating, you can't stop your brain. You said your brain is really at full capacity. There's the emotional side. What am I feeling? Right? Am I feeling dread to a level that's, you know, starting to become encumbering on me? And then also that behavioral piece that you just mentioned, that I think is easier to recognize. Other people have a better chance of recognizing that from the external world. Am I starting to get too controlling? Am I starting to need to micromanage people so I feel a sense of control, right? Which can have knock-on effects and cause anxiety in others. So I think that's just, it's so so interesting to look for those three kind of categories of signs. And as such an expert in this field, and with your work with leaders all around the world, what have you seen as some of the first early interventions when you think your anxiety levels are becoming a little bit too high? What are some of the things you can do? Are there quick strategies? Are there longer term? What works?
Everyone's different. I want to add another element of how we know anxiety is entering our realm. Anxiety is physical. It's a, right? You know this. It's a 360 feeling. And often what I tell people is tune into your body. You know, not all of us, most of us, aren't raised with a lot of mental health literacy. We aren't taught as kids, this is what anxiety feels like. You know, this is changing, and I think that's amazing. I see it in my kids. But a lot of us, we're into our 30s until we realize, oh my gosh, I'm anxious. This is why I'm doing this. And so one of the easiest ways in is to tune into your body, right? And learn to sort of play detective, as my friend Rebecca Harley calls it, right? For me, my tell is my shoulders and jaw. Some people's tell might be they don't sleep well. Their appetite changes. They feel jumpy. They can't concentrate. People tell me they often feel a tingling in their body. We may have behavioral changes, right? As you mentioned, we may have emotional changes. So it's really important to start to tune in. And therapy is, I think, really essential for this, you know, getting help. I mean, the good news about anxiety is it's so common. Yes. It's so common. On any given day, over a third of Americans are diagnosed with anxiety. So you can imagine how many other people are walking around with it. And so there's a lot of great interventions. I would say for me, one of the most powerful interventions has been learning cognitive behavioral therapy tools, you know, so that I can literally help change my cognition, my distorted thoughts, my worries, but also addressing my body. Because sometimes our brain shuts off and the body experience of anxiety takes over, especially this can happen at work. And so learning tools to calm your body so your brain can kick in is also really, really important. Mindfulness is helpful there too.
Mindfulness and breath. When I was feeling completely overwhelmed the other day, I just took 5 minutes to go into my office, close the door and breathe. Do nothing more than breathe. And I found that changed my state in such a powerful way that that power of the body cannot be underestimated. And when we can kind of relax our body and relax our nervous system, you're right, that's exactly when the blood comes to your brain again. And you can just calm.
You know, one of the things that I always tell people that's so interesting for those of us who are on a device or on screens most of the day is that, right, there's research that we don't breathe well when we're on screen. And I don't know about you, my stomach is very tight at work and I'm not breathing well. My breath is all up here and that revs up the nervous system. And so you're right, taking a pause, a few minutes of just intentional breathing. And if your breath is just too tight, if it just feels too hard to get it down into your belly and deeper, two fingers on your wrist and tune into your pulse, right? Tune into your heartbeat. Put your hands on your sternum. Anything that just allows you to just come into yourself for a minute and try to regulate.
I think it's super helpful. I'm going to try that next time because you can put two fingers on your pulse even when you're in front of a class and just to check in with yourself.
Casual.
You mentioned that, you know, anxiety is on the rise. And absolutely, the World Health Organization has said it's increasing every year since the pandemic. What do you think are the things in the that are responsible for this? Why is anxiety on the rise? I often get asked the question, is it just because we're able to label it now? Or, you know, what gives? What's happening with that?
Well, I'll tell you what I think, and then I want to hear what you think. I have asked so many people this question, you know, American Psychological Association. My firm belief, knowing the physiological roots of anxiety, is that humans have always felt extremely anxious, right? I would think that when we lived in a world where there wasn't penicillin in case our children got sick from everyday illnesses, we felt very anxious, right? The physical threats to our well-being were more prominent. And so it seems impossible to me that we are physically more anxious, neurologically more anxious than previous generations. So what gives, right? I think that there are a few things. I do think that there is more literacy around it, especially we see this in younger generations, right? They are talking about it. They're talking about it on social media. They're very in touch with it. Emotions are very important. I see how has leadership literature changed, right? Even in the past 10, 15 years. I think in America, what's really interesting, I don't know about Europe, is, you know, we have Oprah. You cannot underestimate the impact. We have movie stars talking about this. We have Dr. Phil. The impact of our culture talking about our feelings and our emotions puts us in touch. And then I do truly believe that the digital revolution and how it has impacted our lives and our work is driving more anxiety, and there are deep systemic factors, right, that we're more in touch with. I, as a privileged white person, am now understanding. I can't truly understand it, but I can try. I can understand the anxiety that the economic insecurity of people in this country feel. I can understand the anxiety that Black people feel living and driving while Black. And that's a conversation we're having, right? And so I think there's a lot of different factors that are making anxiety measure up
more.
Yeah,
I think it's such an important point that we sit, you know, it might be not be on a conscious level all the time that we're worrying about everything going on, but we can't separate ourselves from the system that we sit in. And we have access to information and our work and our mobile phones at an instant. So we're not disconnecting, and just one look at the news is enough to trigger your nervous system. At the moment, we have, you know, we have war, we have devastation, we have, you know, children and human suffering, and it doesn't, we don't leave that at the door when we walk into the workplace. It's part and parcel of who we are in the world we're connected to. So I think it's absolutely right that this digital revolution is changing how we think, it's changing how we access and what we access. And I think that that's sitting, sometimes not consciously, but it's sitting under the surface of who we are at work and when we're leading.
So in my previous career, I worked in digital for 2 decades. And here's what I know. Social media was designed to trigger us. That's the business model. And one of the interesting things that's happened in work, especially post-pandemic, as most of us have moved to different schedules, we're more hybrid, we're more reliant on digital interfaces like Slack, like Teams, of course, email, text, that also, in a way, are designed to keep us in a state of heightened arousal. So of course we're more anxious.
Absolutely. We're not able to disconnect anymore, right?
No. We see images of the war come in very graphic detail in the palm of our hand, and then we have to go lead a meeting, right? And that's new.
Absolutely, that is new. It adds a layer of complexity and exhaustion, you know, physically and mentally for people. So, switching actually to that leadership lens, when you're leading others, I get asked the question a lot, and I'd love to hear your perspective on, you know, and you mentioned the Gen Z generation who have much more expectations of their leaders to have conversations about this, to understand, to work with the whole self of the individual. What would you say for a leader in managing others' anxiety? How do you lead others through this? How do you create awareness and have that? What do you start with if you're a leader who wants to better tap into this dynamic and help others?
I hate this cliche, but I'm going to use it. You can't help others if you haven't helped yourself. So I think it's really important. And it's funny, and I see this happen at companies, and I'm always interested why, that managers are so well-meaning, and they take courses, and they want to talk to their teams. And when I ask them, well, how do you experience anxiety? I don't. And so I think that it's really important, even if you don't consider yourself an anxious person, to get introspective and to really understand your mind, body, spirit as a leader. To your point, we bring our whole selves to work every day. We don't really have a choice. And so that's really important. And especially if you're from a generation, if you're from a culture, gender has a role to play, religion. There's so many different intersections here where the permission to feel, right, as Mark Brackett calls it, was not part of your repertoire. It can be scary. And then the hardest thing I hear from people, I don't know about you, is I feel like I have to be people's therapist.
Absolutely.
I'm not a what? Plus, I don't have extra time. I have less staff than ever. My expectations are higher from people above me. And now my team wants my emotional support all day. Help. It's overwhelming. So I think that we have to acknowledge that and really invest and help managers build skills, because this stuff isn't easy. We're not taught it, unfortunately. You're changing that. And it takes practice and it takes introspection.
Yeah, it's a new conversation, right? That does take skill, ability, and a little bit more time, right? About not just checking in with your team and your people about, you know, how have you progressed on that task or your KPIs, but how are you doing, right? Do you feel energized? Do you feel overwhelmed? And what can we do to support you the best? And I think it's so important, the point you made, that we're not asking leaders to become therapists. In fact, they shouldn't become therapists. That's absolutely crossing a boundary. It's about just raising the awareness of the things to look for and the support you can give and what you have access to. That's most critical. I just think that's spot on. And so you have talked in your podcast, The Anxious Achiever, you have talked to achievers and leaders all around the world. Who would you say are some leaders that have inspired you that we should go listen to that episode, or that you've seen that have inspired you around your book, to write a book on this topic? You know, do you have any advice for us?
I have admiration for all the leaders who have come and talked to me. It's not easy. There's so much shame around the topic of mental health, mental illness, vulnerability, admitting that you are anxious. So I'm always thrilled when someone agrees to talk to me on the record. It's very exciting to me still. It shouldn't be, but it is, unfortunately, because it's hard. You know, one of the most profound leader interviews that I ever did, I really love it, was with a man named Jimmy Horowitz. And he is basically the number two at one of the largest media conglomerates in the world, NBC Universal. And he runs all business affairs, right? Contracts, legal acquisitions, all of that stuff. And Jimmy's experience is really powerful. And actually, it was a workplace psychologist, Dr. Emily Anhalt, who brought Jimmy to me because she worked with him and the team at NBC to learn how to talk about this stuff. And Jimmy went through a clinical depression. And for about 6 months, he showed up at work. This was right before the pandemic. And he closed the shades in his office, and he kept to himself, and he did his work because, you know, you can be clinically depressed and still functional enough, right, to do your work. And he didn't talk about it. And he said to me, you know, people knew there was something off, but I don't think they knew how to talk about it, you know? And it wasn't until, and he was getting therapy, he was getting treatment at the same time. It wasn't until during the pandemic, right, when mental health broke open and his company started a mental health task force, hired Dr. Emily Anhalt, asked Jimmy to be the executive sponsor, not knowing that he had been through it himself. And he said, I couldn't lie anymore. You know, I had to come clean. And when he did this, and by this point, he was in a good place in his own healing journey. And that's really important. You know, he said that it was really profound. Not only did it help other people feel seen and able to get help and be more vulnerable, he said it changed his philosophy as a leader. He came from the old school, especially in Hollywood. You don't leave work before your boss does. Even if you have nothing to do, you stay there, right? You show up. You work hard. You miss your kid's soccer game. And he said, you know, after I went through this experience, I couldn't ask that of my team anymore. I wanted them to live their whole lives. I knew the pain and loneliness I had been through. I didn't want that for my team. And I thought he was just really remarkable. He was obviously a very introspective and compassionate guy. But the way that his experience with mental illness changed his whole approach to management and leadership is one of the most powerful arguments I can think of for going to therapy, doing the work.
Oh, I think that's so inspiring. And I can hear so many different themes coming out in that around first starting with self-awareness, what's going on, you know, developing the skills to actually have the conversation and the empathy to try to understand what people are going through, and also the intent to make a positive impact. And that really involves challenging assumptions about sometimes who you are, you know, what does leadership mean? What does success mean? And, you know, what does good work mean? And I think sometimes there's this assumption that if you take care of mental health, that goes against high task performance, which is just not the case. In fact, you need to take care of your energy, your mental health, your well-being in order to have good performance. So I think that strange narrative we have in the business world that it's either or, stories like that help to shift the needle on and help to change how we think about human sustainability at its core.
The thing that's ironic to me, Allison, also is that we are obsessed with human performance, especially as it applies to leadership. The quantified self, maximizing, is really common parlance in leadership culture, but we don't talk about the tough stuff often. And that just makes no sense to me, right? The leadership story that I hear more often than Jimmy's, I was thinking of Diane Patrick, who is very well known in my home state of Massachusetts because she was the first lady of Governor Deval Patrick for a long time. But she is a hugely accomplished woman in her own right, was a partner at a huge law firm for many years, was general counsel at Harvard, very, very prominent person. And her relay is more common. I interviewed her and she told me that for decades, she was high functioning, clinically anxious. She was a perfectionist. She had always been a high achiever. She always got straight A's, right? She was one of those, went to a great law school, had a big career in corporate law. And a friend said to her many years ago, "You are a duck in water, a swan in water. You look great up top, everything's sliding off your feathers, but I know underneath you're just frantically paddling to try." And she said, "You know, that was so true, but I didn't know an alternative. I knew how to achieve. I knew how to be great at my job. I was so used to anxiety, just, you know, basically," she didn't say this, but basically being my oxygen and managing it however I could. And it all came to a head while she was first lady. And she became really ill and had to take time out of public life and get really intensive treatment. And was not initially public about it, became public about it. And the reason why this is the story that I hear more often is that people reach a crisis point before they get help. And I hear that way too much. They have to get hospitalized. They think that they are having a heart attack because they're having panic anxiety that is so intense. They have burnout. They turn to substances. And of course, when Diane Patrick went public with her mental illness, the floodgates opened. I mean, in this state, people loved her. They wanted to talk, but why did it take decades, right? And so that's what I don't want to happen. I don't want people to get to crisis.
I think that's such an inspiring story. And it really aligns with some of the research findings we have here at IMD these days, that if leaders disclose, if they talk about it, actually, the opposite happens than what they think will happen. We often think people will lose confidence in our abilities. And our latest findings are showing that it's actually the opposite. Employees feel more confident in our abilities and more identified with us. And it doesn't impact their perceptions of your competence as a leader. And we found that both for women and for men. And I think that was a really inspiring finding for me, because often I do work in leadership and gender, and often women can be highly penalized for talking about some things like this. But in one of our recent studies, we're finding that it's not happening. So maybe that narrative, I have hope that the narrative is changing around leadership and that need to be a hero and be invulnerable. So I think, you know, thank you so much for these inspiring stories. I just think your work is so important. I think you are having the right conversations. And like you say, these difficult conversations are the ones we need to have. And I think just by talking about it and through the work you do, you're really starting to move the needle and change the conversation going forward. So thank you so much, Maura.
So are you, Allison. Thank you. And I really would love to have you back on my podcast to talk about that research, because people need to know about that.
All right. Sign me up.